she said. And on the last word, she lifted her voice, mocking me. Look, I told her, if he was a child, I'd do it. And she cut me off, saying, whatever. Then she rolled her eyes and glared out the window. The woman had decided that I was a hard ass, one of those guys who refuses under any circumstances to do anyone a favor. But it's not true. I just prefer that the favor be my idea, and that it leaves me feeling kind rather than bullied and uncomfortable. So no, let her sulk, I decided. Eric had stopped waving and signaled for me to get Becky's attention. My wife, he mouthed. Get my wife. There was no way out, and so I tapped the woman on the shoulder. Don't touch me, she said, all dramatic, as if I had thrown a punch. Your husband wants you. Well, that doesn't give you a right to touch me. Becky unbuckled her seatbelt, raised herself off the cushion, and spoke to Eric in a loud stage whisper. I asked him to swap seats, but he won't do it. He cocked his head, sign language for, how come? And she said, much louder than she needed to, 'cause he's an asshole. That's why. An elderly woman across the aisle turned to look at me, and I pulled the Times crossword puzzle from the bag beneath my seat. That always makes you look reasonable. Especially on a Saturday when the words are long and the clues are exceptionally tough. The problem is that you have to concentrate, and all I could think of was this woman. 17 across. A 15-letter word for enlightenment. I am not an asshole, I wrote. And it fit. Five down, 6-letter Indian tribe. You are. Look at the smart man breezing through the puzzle, I imagined everyone thinking. He must be a genius. That's why he wouldn't swap seats for that poor married woman. He knows something we don't. It's pathetic how much significance I attach to the Times puzzle, which is easy on Monday and gets progressively harder as the week advances. I'll spend 15 hours finishing the Friday, and then I'll wave it in someone's face and demand that they acknowledge my superior intelligence. I think it means that I'm smarter than the next guy, but all it really means is that I don't have a life. As I turned to my puzzle, Becky reached for a paperback novel, the kind with an embossed cover. I strained to see what the title was, and she jerked it closer to the window. Strange how that happens, how you can feel someone's eyes on your book or magazine as surely as you can feel a touch. It only works for the written word, though. I stared at her feet for a good 5 minutes, and she never jerked those away. After our flight, she'd removed her sneakers, and I saw that her toenails were painted white and that each one was perfectly sculpted. 18 across. Not impressed. 11 down. Whore. I wasn't even looking at the clues anymore. When the drink cart came, we fought through the flight attendant. What can I offer you folks, she asked. And Becky threw down her book saying, we're not together. It killed her that we might be mistaken for a couple, or even friends for that matter. I'm traveling with my husband, she continued. He's sitting up there in the bulkhead. You learned that word from me, I thought. Well, can I offer? I'll have a Coke, Becky said. Not much ice. I was thirsty as well, but more than a drink, I wanted the flight attendant to like me. And who would you prefer, the finicky baby who cuts you off and gets all specific about her ice cubes, or the thoughtful, non-demanding gentleman who smiles up from his difficult Saturday puzzle, saying, "Nothing for me, thank you." With a plane to lose altitude, the only way to stay aloft was to push one person out the emergency exit. I now felt certain that the flight attendant would select Becky rather than myself. I pictured her clinging to the doorframe, her hair blown so hard it was starting to fall out. "But my husband," she'd cry. Then I would step forward saying, "Hey, I've been to Raleigh before. Take me instead." Becky would see that I am not the asshole she mistook me for. And in that instant, she would lose her grip. And be sucked into space. Two down. Take that. It's always so satisfying when you can twist someone's hatred into guilt. Make them realize that they were wrong, too quick to judge, too unwilling to look beyond their own petty concerns. The problem is that it works both ways. I'd taken this woman as the type who arrives late at a movie and then asks me to move behind the tallest person in the theater so that she and her husband can sit together. Everyone has to suffer just because she's sleeping with someone. But what if I was wrong? I pictured her in a dimly lit room, trembling before a portfolio of glowing x-rays. "I give you 2 weeks at the most," the doctor says. "Why don't you get your toenails done? Buy yourself a nice pair of cutoffs and spend some quality time with your husband. I hear the beaches of North Carolina are pretty this time of year." I looked at her then and thought, no. If she'd had so much as a stomach ache, she would have mentioned it. Or would she? I kept telling myself that I was within my rights, but I knew it wasn't working when I turned back to my puzzle and started listing the various reasons why I was not an asshole. 40 across. "I give money to puh." 46 down. "Ublick radio." While groping for reason number 2, I couldn't help but notice that Becky was not making a list of her own. She was the one who'd called me a name, who went out of her way to stir up trouble, but it didn't seem to bother her in the least. After finishing her Coke, she folded up her tray table, summoned the flight attendant to take her empty can, and settled back for a nap. It was shortly afterwards that I put the throat lozenge in my mouth, and shortly after that I sneezed, and it shot like a bullet into the crotch of her shorts. 9 across. Fuck! "13 down. Now what?" It was then that another option occurred to me. You know, I thought, maybe I will swap places with her husband. But I'd waited too long, and now he was asleep as well. My only way out was to wake this woman up and make her the same offer I sometimes make to Hugh. We'll be arguing, and I'll stop at mid-sentence and ask if we can just start over. I'll go outside, and when I come back in, we'll just pretend this never happened, okay? If the fight is huge, he'll wait until I'm in the hall, then bolt the door behind me. But if it's minor, he'll go along, and I'll re-enter the apartment saying, "What are you doing home?" Or, "Gee, it smells good in here. What's cooking?" An easy question, as he's always got something on the stove. For a while, it feels goofy, but eventually the self-consciousness wears off, and we ease into the roles of two decent people, trapped in a rather dull play. "Is there anything I can do to help?" "You can set the table if you want." "All righty then." I don't know how many times I've set the table in the middle of the afternoon. Long before we eventually sit down to eat. But the play would be all the duller without action. And I don't want to do anything really hard, like paint a room. I'm just so grateful he goes along with it. Other people's lives can be full of screaming and flying plates, but I prefer that my own remains as civil as possible, even if that means faking it every once in a while. I'd gladly have started over with Becky, but something told me she wouldn't go for it. Even asleep, she broadcast her hostility, each gentle snore sounding like an accusation. Asshole. Asshole. The landing announcement failed to wake her, and when the flight attendant stopped in the aisle and asked her to fasten her seatbelt, she did it in a drowse, without looking. The lozenge disappeared beneath the buckle, and this bought me an extra 10 minutes. Time spent gathering my things so I could make for the door the moment we arrived at our gate. I just didn't count on the man in front of me being a little bit quicker and holding me up as he wrestled his duffel bag from the overhead bin. Had it not been for him, I might have been gone by the time Becky unfastened her seatbelt. But as it was, I was only 4 rows away, standing, as it turned out, right beside the bulkhead. The name she called me was nothing I hadn't heard before, and nothing I won't hear again, probably. 8 letters. And the clue might read, above the shoulders, he's nothing but crap. Of course, they don't put words like that in the Times puzzle. If they did, anyone could finish it. The understudy. In the spring of 1967, my mother and father went out of town for the weekend and left my 4 sisters and me in the company of a woman named Mrs. Bird, who was old and black and worked as a maid for one of our neighbors. She arrived at our house on a Friday afternoon, and after carrying her suitcase to my parents' bedroom, I gave her a little tour, the way I imagined they did in hotels. This is your TV. This is your private sun deck. And over here you've got your bathroom, just yours and nobody else's. Mrs. Bird put her hand to her cheek. Somebody pinch me, I'm about to fall out. She cooed again when I opened a dresser drawer and explained that when it came to coats and so forth, we favored a little room called a closet. There are 2 of them against the wall there, and you can use the one on the right. It was, I thought, a dream for her. Your telephone. Your massive bed. Your glass-doored shower stall. All you had to do was leave it a little cleaner than you found it. A few months later, my parents went away again and left us with Mrs. Robbins, who was also black, and who, like Mrs. Bird, allowed me to see myself as a miracle worker. Night fell, and I pictured her kneeling on the carpet, her forehead grazing my parents' gold bedspread. Thank you, Jesus, for these wonderful white people, and all that they have given me this fine weekend. With the regular teenage babysitter, you horsed around, jumped her on the way out of the bathroom, that sort of thing. But with Mrs. Robbins and Mrs. Bird, we were respectful and well-behaved, not like ourselves at all. This made our parents' getaway weekend a getaway for us as well. For what was a vacation but a chance to be somebody different? In early September of that same year, my parents joined my Aunt Joyce and Uncle Dick for a week in the Virgin Islands. Neither Mrs. Bird nor Mrs. Robbins was available to stay with us, and so my mother found someone named Mrs. Peacock. Exactly where she found her would be speculated on for the remainder of our childhoods. "Has Mom ever been to a woman's prison?" my sister Amy would ask. "Try a man's prison," Gretchen would say, as she was never convinced that Mrs. Peacock was a legitimate female. The Mrs. part was a lie anyway. That much we knew. She just says she was married so people will believe in her. This was one of the insights we recorded in a notebook while she was staying with us. There were pages of them, all written in a desperate scrawl with lots of exclamation points and underlined words. It was the sort of writing you might do when a ship was going down. The sort that would give your surviving loved ones an actual chill. If only we had known, they'd moan. Oh, for the love of God, if only we had known. But what was there to know, really? Some 15-year-old offers to watch your kids for the night, and sure, you ask her parents about her, you nose around. But with a grown woman, you didn't demand a reference, especially if the woman were white. Our mother could never remember where she had found Mrs. Peacock. A newspaper ad, she'd say, or, I don't know, maybe she sat for somebody at the club. But who at the club would have hired such a creature? In order to become a member, you had to meet certain requirements, one of them being that you did not know people like Mrs. Peacock. You did not go to places where she ate or worshipped, and you certainly didn't give her the run of your home. I smelled trouble the moment her car pulled up, a piece of junk driven by a guy with no shirt on. He looked just old enough to start shaving, and remained seated as the figure beside him pushed open the door and eased her way out. This was Mrs. Peacock, and the first thing I noticed was her hair, which was the color of margarine and fell in waves to the middle of her back. It was a sort of hair you might find on a mermaid, completely wrong for a 60-year-old woman who was not just heavy but fat and moved as if each step might be her last. "Mom," I called. And as my mother stepped out of the house, the man with no shirt backed out of the driveway and peeled off down the street. "Was that your husband?" my mother asked. And Mrs. Peacock looked at the spot where the car had been. "Nah," she said, "that's just Keith." Not my nephew Keith, or Keith who works at the filling station and is wanted in 5 states, but just Keith, as if we had read a book about her life and were expected to remember all the characters. She'd do this a lot over the coming week, and I would grow to hate her for it. Someone would phone the house, and after hanging up, she'd say, "So much for Eugene," or, "I told Vicky not to call me here no more." "Who's Eugene?" we'd ask. "What did Vicky do that was so bad?" She'd tell us to mind our own business. She had this attitude, not that she was better than us, but that she was as good as us, and that simply was not true. Look at her suitcase, tied shut with rope. Listen to her mumble, not a clear sentence to be had. A polite person would express admiration when given a tour of the house, but aside from a few questions regarding the stovetop, Mrs. Peacock said very little, and merely shrugged when shown the master bathroom, which had the word master in it and was supposed to make you feel powerful and lucky to be alive. "I've seen better," her look seemed to say. But I didn't for one moment believe it. The first 2 times my parents left for vacation, my sisters and I escorted them to the door and said that we would miss them terribly. It was just an act designed to make us look sensitive and English, but on this occasion, we meant it. "Oh, stop being such babies," our mother said. "It's only a week." Then she gave Mrs. Peacock the look meaning, "Kids, what are you going to do?" There was a corresponding look that translated to, "You tell me." But Mrs. Peacock didn't need it, for she knew exactly what she was going to do. Enslave us. There was no other word for it. An hour after my parents left, she was lying face down on their bed, dressed in nothing but her slip. Like her skin, it was the color of Vaseline, an uncolor, really, which looked even worse with yellow hair. Add to this her great bare legs, which were dimpled at the inner knee and streaked throughout with angry purple veins. My sisters and I attempted diplomacy. "Isn't there, perhaps, some work to be done?"
"You there, the one with the glasses."
Mrs. Peacock pointed at my sister Gretchen.
"Your mama mentioned they's some soda pop in the kitchen. Go fetch me one, why don't you?"
"Do you mean Coke?" Gretchen asked.
"That'll do," Mrs. Peacock said. "And put it in a mug with ice in it." While Gretchen got the Coke, I was instructed to close the drapes. It was, to me, an idea that bordered on insanity, and I tried my best to talk her out of it. "The private deck is your room's best feature," I said. "Do you really want to block it out while the sun's still shining?" She did. Then she wanted her suitcase. My sister Amy put it on the bed, and we watched as Mrs. Peacock untied the rope and reached inside, removing a plastic hand attached to a foot-long wand. The business end was no bigger than a monkey's paw, the fingers bent slightly inward, as if they had been frozen in the act of begging. It was a nasty little thing, the nails slick with grease, and over the coming week we were to see a lot of it. To this day, should any of our boyfriends demand a back scratch, my sisters and I recoil. "Brush yourself against a brick wall," we say. "Hire a nurse, but don't look at me. I've done my time." No one spoke of carpal tunnel syndrome in the late 1960s, but that doesn't mean that it didn't exist. There just wasn't a name for it. Again and again, we ran the paw over Mrs. Peacock's back, the fingers leaving white trails and sometimes welts. "Ease up," she'd say. The straps of her slip lowered to her forearms. The side of her face mashed flat against the gold bedspread. "I ain't made of stone, you know." That much was clear. Stone didn't sweat. Stone didn't stink or break out in a rash. And it certainly didn't sprout little black hairs between its shoulder blades. We drew this last one to Mrs. Peacock's attention, and she responded saying, "Y'all's got the same damn thing, only they ain't poked out yet." This one was written down verbatim and read aloud during the daily crisis meetings my sister and I had taken to holding in the woods behind our house. "Y'all's got the same damn thing, only they ain't poked out yet." It sounded chilling when said in her voice, and even worse when recited normally, without the mumble and the country accent. "Can't speak English," I wrote in the complaint book. "Can't go 2 minutes without using the word damn. Can't cook worth a damn hoot." The last part was not quite true, but it wouldn't have hurt her to expand her repertoire. "Sloppy Joe, Sloppy Joe, Sloppy Joe," held over our heads as if it were steak. Nobody ate unless they earned it, which meant fetching her drinks, brushing her hair, driving the monkey paw into her shoulders until she moaned. Mealtime came and went, her too full of Coke and potato chips to notice until one of us dared to mention it. "If y'all was hungry, why didn't you say nothing? I ain't a mind reader, you know."
Then she'd slam around the kitchen, her upper arms jiggling as she threw the pan on the burner, pitched in some ground beef, shook ketchup into it. My sisters and I sat at the table, but Mrs. Peacock ate standing, like a cow, we thought, a cow with a telephone.
"You tell Curtis for me that if he don't run Tanya to R.C.'s hearing, he'll have to answer to both me and Gene Jr., and that's no lie."
Her calls reminded her that she was far away from the action. Events were coming to a head. The drama with Ray, the business between Kim and Lucille. And here she was, stuck in the middle of nowhere. That's how she saw our house, the end of the earth. In a few years' time, I'd be the first to agree with her. But when I was 11, and you could still smell the fresh pine joists from behind the sheet-rocked walls, I thought there was no finer place to be. "I'd like to see where she lives," I said to my sister Lisa. And then, as punishment, we did see. This occurred on day 5 and was Amy's fault, at least according to Mrs. Peacock. Any sane adult, anyone with children, might have taken the blame upon herself. Oh well, she would have thought, it was bound to happen sooner or later. 7-year-old girl, her arm worn to rubber after hours of back scratching, carries a monkey paw into the master bathroom where it drops from her hand and falls to the tile floor. The fingers shattered clean off, leaving nothing. A jagged little fist at the end of a stick.
"Now you done it,"
Mrs. Peacock said. All of us to bed without supper, and the next morning Keith pulled up, still with no shirt on. He honked in the driveway, and she shouted at him through the closed door to hold his damn horses.
"I don't think he can hear you," Gretchen said.
And Mrs. Peacock told her she'd had all the lip she was going to take. She'd had all the lip she was going to take from any of us. And so we were quiet as we piled into the car. Keith telling a convoluted story about him and someone named Sherwood as he sped beyond the Raleigh we knew and into a neighborhood of barking dogs and gravel driveways. The houses looked like something a child might draw, a row of shaky squares with triangles on top. Add a door, add two windows. Think of putting a tree in the front yard and then decide against it because branches aren't worth the trouble. Mrs. Peacock's place was divided in half, her in the back and someone named Leslie living in front. A man named Leslie, who wore fatigues and stood by the mailbox play wrestling with the Doberman Pinscher as we drove up. I thought he would scowl at the sight of Mrs. Peacock, but instead he smiled and waved, and she waved in return. Five children wedged into the back seat, children just dying to report that they'd been abducted, but Leslie didn't seem to notice us any more than Keith had. When the car stopped, Mrs. Peacock turned around in the front seat and announced that she had some work that needed doing. "Go ahead," we told her. "We'll wait here."
"Like fun you will," she said.
We started outdoors, picking up turds deposited by the Doberman, whose name turned out to be Rascal. The front yard was mined with them, but the back, which Mrs. Peacock tended, was surprisingly normal. Better than normal, really. There was a small lawn, and along its border, a narrow bed of low-lying flowers. Pansies, I think. There were more flowers on the patio outside her door, most of them in plastic pots and kept company by little ceramic creatures. A squirrel with its tail broken off. A smiling toad. I thought of Mrs. Peacock as a person for whom the word cute did not register, and so it was startling to enter her half of the house and find it filled with dolls. There must have been 100 of them, all squeezed into a single room. There were dolls sitting on the television, dolls standing with their feet glued to the top of the electric fan, and tons more crowded onto floor-to-ceiling shelves. Strange to me was that she hadn't segregated them according to size or quality. Here was a fashion model in a stylish dress, dwarfed by a cheap, bawling baby, or a little girl who'd apparently come too close to the hot plate, her hair singed off, her face disfigured into a frown.
"First rule is that nobody touches nothing," Mrs. Peacock said. "Not nobody and not for no reason."
She obviously thought that her home was something special, a children's paradise, a land of enchantment, but to me it was just overcrowded. "And dark," my sisters would later add, "and hot and smelly." Mrs. Peacock had a Dixie cup dispenser mounted to the wall above her dresser. She kept her bedroom slippers outside the bathroom door, and inside each one was a little troll doll, its hair blown back as if by a fierce wind.
"See," she told us, "it's like they's riding in boats."
"Right," we said. "That's really something." She then pointed out a miniature kitchen set displayed on one of the lower shelves.
"The refrigerator broke, so I made me another one out of a matchbox. Get up close and y'all can look at it."
"You made this?" we said. Though, of course, it was obvious. The strike pad gave it away. Mrs. Peacock was clearly trying to be a good hostess, but I wished she would stop. My opinion of her had already been formed, was written on paper even, and factoring in her small kindnesses would only muddy the report. Like any normal fifth grader, I preferred my villains to be evil and stay that way. To act like Dracula rather than Frankenstein's monster, who ruined everything by handing that peasant girl a flower. He sort of made up for it by drowning her a few minutes later, but still you couldn't look at him in quite the same way again. My sisters and I didn't want to understand Mrs. Peacock. We just wanted to hate her. And so we were relieved when she reached into her closet and withdrew another back scratcher. The good one, apparently. It was no larger than the earlier model, but the hand was slimmer and more clearly defined, that of a lady rather than a monkey. The moment she had it, the hostess act melted away. Off came the man's shirt she'd worn over her slip, and she took up her position on the bed,
surrounded by the baby dolls she referred to as doll babies. Gretchen was given the first shift, and the rest of us were sent outside to pull weeds in the blistering sun. "Thank God," I said to Lisa. I was worried for a minute there that we'd have to feel sorry for her. As children, we suspected that Mrs. Peacock was crazy, a catch-all term we used for anyone who did not recognize our charms. As adults, though, we narrow it down and wonder if she wasn't clinically depressed. The drastic mood swings, the hours of sleep, a gloom so heavy she was unable to get dressed or wash herself. Thus the slip. Thus the hair that grew greasier and greasier as the week progressed and left a permanent stain on our parents' gold bedspread. "I wonder if she'd been institutionalized," Lisa will say. "Maybe she had shock treatments, which is what they did back then, the poor thing." We'd like to have been that compassionate as children, but we already had our list, and it was unthinkable to disregard it on account of a lousy matchbox. Our parents returned from their vacation, and before they even stepped out of the car, we were upon them, a mob, all of us talking at the same time.
"She made us go to her shack and pick up turds. She sent us to bed one night without supper. She said the master bathroom was ugly and that you were stupid to have air conditioning."
"All right," our mother said. "Jesus, calm down."
"She made us scratch her back until our arms almost fell off. She cooked sloppy joes every night, and when we ran out of buns, she told us to eat it on crackers."
We were still at it when Mrs. Peacock stepped from the breakfast nook and out into the carport. She was dressed for once and even had shoes on, but it was too late to play normal. In the presence of my mother, who was tanned and pretty, she looked all the more unhealthy, sinister almost, her mouth twisted into a freaky smile.
"She spent the whole week in bed and didn't do laundry until last night."
I guess I expected a violent showdown. How else to explain my disappointment when instead of slapping Mrs. Peacock across the face, my mother looked her in the eye and said, "Oh, come on. I don't believe that for a minute." It was the phrase she used when she believed every word of it, but was too tired to care.
"But she abducted us!"
"Well, good for her." Our mother led Mrs. Peacock into the house and left my sisters and me standing in the carport. "Aren't they just horrible?" she said. "Honest to God, I don't know how you put up with them for an entire week."
"You don't know how she put up with us!"
Slam went the door, right in our faces. And then our mom sat her guest down in the breakfast nook and offered her a drink. Framed through the window, they looked like figures on a stage. Two characters who seem like opposites and then discover that they have a lot in common. A similarly hard upbringing. A fondness for the jugged burgundies of California. And a mutual disregard for the rowdy matinee audience pitching their catcalls from beyond the parted curtain.
Town and country. They looked like people who had just attended a horse show. A stately couple in their late 60s, him in a cashmere blazer, and her in a gray tweed jacket, a gem-encrusted shamrock glittering against the rich felt of her lapel. They were my seatmates on the flight from Denver to New York, and as I stood in the aisle to let them in, I felt the shame of the tragically outclassed. The sport coat I had prided myself on now looked clownish, as did my shoes, and the fistful of pine straw I referred to as my hair. "Excuse me," I said, apologizing basically for my very existence. The couple took their seat, and just as I settled in beside them, the man turned to the woman, saying, "I don't want to hear this shit." I assumed he was continuing an earlier argument, but it turned out he was referring to the George Gershwin number the airline had adopted as its theme song. "I can't believe the fucking crap they make you listen to on planes nowadays." The woman patted her silver hair and agreed with him, saying that whoever had programmed the music was an asshole. A cocksucker, the man corrected her. A goddamn cocksucking asshole. They weren't loud people. They didn't even sound all that angry, really. This was just the way they spoke. The verbal equivalent of the everyday China. Amongst company, the wife might remark that she felt a slight chill, but hear that translated to, "I'm fucking freezing." "How about you?" "Yeah," her husband said, "it's cold as shit in here." Shit is the tofu of cursing. And can be molded to whichever conditions the speaker desires. Hot as shit. Windy as shit. I myself was confounded as shit. For how had I so misjudged these people? Why, after all these years, do I still believe that expensive clothing signifies anything more than a disposable income? That tweed and cashmere actually bespeak refinement. When our boxed bistro meals were handed out, the couple really went off. "What is this garbage?" the man asked. "It's shit," his wife said. "A box of absolute fucking shit." The man took out his reading glasses and briefly examined his plastic-wrapped cookie before tossing it back in the box. "First they make you listen to shit, and then they make you eat it." "Well, I'm not fucking eating it," the woman said. "We'll just have to grab something at the airport. And pay some son of a bitch $15 for a sandwich?" The woman sighed and threw up her hands. "What choice do we have? It's either that or eat what we've got, which is shit." "Oh, it's all shit," her husband said. It was as if they'd kidnapped the grandparents from a Ralph Lauren ad. And forced them into a David Mamet play. And that, in part, is why the couple so appealed to me. There was something ridiculous and unexpected about them. They made a good team, and I wished that I could spend a week or two invisibly following behind them and seeing the world through their eyes. "Thanksgiving dinner, my ass," I imagine them saying. It was late afternoon by the time we arrived at LaGuardia. I caught a cab outside the baggage claim and stepped into what smelled like a bad tropical cocktail. This the result of a coconut air freshener that dangled from the rearview mirror. One hates to be a baby about this type of thing, and so I cracked the window a bit and gave the driver my sister's address in the West Village. "Yes, sir." The man was foreign, but I have no idea where he was from. One of those tragic countries, I suppose. A land beset by cobras and typhoons. But that's half the world, really. He had dark skin, more brown than olive, and thick black hair he had treated with oil. The teeth of his comb had left deep troughs that ran down the back of his head and disappeared beneath the frayed collar of his shirt. The cab left the curb, and as he merged into traffic, the driver opened the window between the front and back seats and asked me my name. I told him, and he looked at me in the rearview mirror saying, "You are a good man, David, is that right? Are you good?" I said I was okay. And he continued, David is a good name and New York is a good town. Do you think so? I guess, I said. The driver smiled shyly as if I had paid him a compliment, and I wondered what his life was like. One reads things, newspaper profiles and so forth, and gets an idea of the tireless, hardworking immigrant who hits the ground running or, more often, driving. The man couldn't have been older than 35, and after his shift, I imagined that he probably went to school and studied until he couldn't keep his eyes open. A few hours at home with his wife and children, and then it was back to the front seat and on until he earned a diploma and resumed his career as a radiologist. The only thing holding him up was his accent, but that would likely disappear with time and diligence. I thought of my first few months in Paris and of how frustrating it had been when people spoke quickly or used improper French, and then I re-answered his question, speaking as clearly as possible. I have no opinion on the name David, I said. But I agree with you regarding the city of New York. It is a very satisfactory place. He then said something I didn't quite catch, and when I asked him to repeat it, he became agitated and turned in his seat, saying, "What is the problem, David? You cannot hear when a person is talking." I told him my ears were stopped up from the plane ride, though it wasn't true. I could hear him perfectly. I just couldn't understand him. "I ask what you do for a profession," he said. "Do you make a lot of monies? I know by your jacket that you do, David. I know that you are rich." Suddenly, my sport coat looked a lot better. "I get by," I said. "That is to say that I am able to support myself, which is not the same as being rich." He then asked if I had a girlfriend. And when I told him no, he gathered his thick eyebrows and made a little tisking sound. "Oh, David, you need a woman. Not for love, but for the pussy. Which is a necessary thing for a man. Like me, for example, I fuck daily." "Oh," I said. "And this is Tuesday, right?" I'd hoped I might steer him onto another track, the days of the week, maybe, but he was tired of English 101. "How is it that you do not need pussy?" he asked. "Does your dick not stand up?" "Excuse me?" "Sex," he said. "Has no one ever told you about it?" I took the New York Times from my carry-on bag and pretended to read, an act that apparently explained it all. "Oh," the driver said, "I understand. You do not like pussy. You like the dick." "Is that it?" I brought the paper close to my face, and he stuck his arm through the little window and slapped the back of his seat. "David," he said, "David, listen to me when I am talking to you. I ask it, do you like the dick?" "I just work," I told him. "I work, and then I go home, and then I work some more." I was trying to set a good example, trying to be the person I'd imagined him to be, but it was a lost cause. "I fucky fuck every day," he boasted. "Two women. I have a wife and another girl for the weekend. Two kind of pussy. Are you sure you don't like to fucky fuck?" If forced to, I can live with the word pussy, but fucky fuck, was making me carsick. "That is not a real word," I told him. You can say that you fuck, but fucky fuck is just nonsense. Nobody talks that way. You will never get ahead with that kind of language. Traffic thickened due to an accident, and as we slowed to a stop, the driver ran his tongue over his lips. Fucky fuck, he repeated. I fucky 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 fuck. Had we been in Manhattan, I might have gotten out and found myself another taxi, but we were still on the expressway, so what choice did I have but to stay put and look with envy at the approaching rescue vehicles? Eventually, the traffic began moving, and I resigned myself to another 20 minutes of torture. So, you go to the West Village, the driver said. Very good place for you to live. Lots of boys and boys together, girls and girls together. It is not where I live, I said. It is the apartment of my sister. Tell me how those lesbians have sex. How do they do it? I said I didn't know, and he looked at me with the same sad expression he had worn earlier when told that I didn't have a girlfriend. David, he sighed. You have never seen a lesbian movie? You should, you know. You need to go home, drink whiskey, and watch one just to see how it is done. See how they get that pussy. See how they fucky fuck. And then I snapped. Which is unlike me, really. You know, I said, I do not think that I am going to take you up on that. In fact, I know that I am not going to take you up on that. Oh, but you should. Why, I said, so I can be more like you? That's a worthwhile goal, isn't it? I will just get myself a coconut air freshener and drive about town, impressing people with the beautiful language I have picked up from pornographic movies. Hello, sir. Does not your dick stand up? Good afternoon, madam. Do you like to fucky fuck? It sounds enchanting, but I don't know that I could stand to have such a rewarding existence. I am not worthy, okay? So if it is all right with you, I will not watch any lesbian movies tonight or tomorrow night or any other night for that matter. Instead, I will just work and leave people alone. I waited for a response, and when none came, I settled back in my chair, completely ashamed of myself. The driver's familiarity had been maddening, but what I'd said had been cruel and uncalled for, mocking him, bringing up his air freshener. I felt as though I had just kicked a kitten. A filthy one, to be sure, but still something small and powerless. Sex is what you boast about when you have no exterior signs of wealth. It's a way of saying, look, I might not own a fancy sport coat or an apartment in Manhattan, but I do have two women and all the intercourse I can handle. And what would it have hurt me to acknowledge his success? I think it is wonderful that you are so fulfilled, I said. But rather than responding, the driver turned on the radio, which was, of course, tuned to NPR. By the time I got to my sister's, it was dark. I poured myself a scotch, and then, like always, Amy brought out a few things she thought I might find interesting. The first was a copy of The Joy of Sex, which she'd found at a flea market and planned to leave on the coffee table the next time our father visited. What do you think he'll say? She asked. It was the last thing a man would want to find in his daughter's apartment. That was my thought, anyway. But then she handed me a magazine called New Animal Orgy. which was truly the last thing a man would want to find in his daughter's apartment. This was an old issue, dated 1974, and it smelled as if it had spent the past few decades in the dark, not just hidden, but locked in a chest and buried underground. "Isn't that the filthiest thing you've ever seen in your life?" Amy asked. But I found myself too stunned to answer. The magazine was devoted to two major stories, photo essays, I guess you could call them. The first involved a female cyclist who stops to rest beside an abandoned windmill and seduces what the captions referred to as a stray collie. "He's not a stray," Amy said. "Look at that coat. You can practically smell the shampoo." The second story was even sadder and concerned a couple of women named Inga and Bodil who stimulate a white stallion using first their hands and later their tongues. It was supposedly the luckiest day of the horse's life. But if the sex was really that good, you'd think he would stop eating. Or at least do something different with his eyes. Instead, he just went about his business, acting as if the women were not there. On the next page, he's led into the bedroom where he stands on the carpet and stares dumbly at the objects on the woman's dresser. A hairbrush, an aerosol can turned on its side, a framed photo of a woman holding a baby. Above the dresser was a curtainless window, and through it could be seen a field leading to a forest of tall pines. Amy leaned closer and pointed to the bottom of the picture. "Look at the mud on that carpet," she said. But I was way ahead of her. "Number one reason not to blow a horse in your bedroom," I told her. Though it was actually much further down on the list. Number four, maybe. The top slots being reserved for the loss of dignity, the invitation to disease, and the off chance that your parents might drop by. Once again, the women stimulate the horse to an erection, and then they begin to pleasure each other, assuming, I guess, that he will enjoy watching. This doesn't mean they were necessarily lesbians, not any more than the collie was a stray. But still, it gave me pause and forced me to think of the cab driver. "I am not like you," I had told him. Then, half an hour later, here I was, a glass in one hand and in the other, a magazine picturing two naked women making out in front of a stallion. Of course, the circumstances were a bit different. I was drinking scotch instead of whiskey. This was a periodical rather than a video. I was with my sister. And we were just two decent people having a laugh. Weren't we? Thank you. In the waiting room. 6 months after moving to Paris, I dropped out of French school and decided to take the easy way out. All I ever said was, "Could you repeat that?" And for what? I rarely understood things the second time round. And when I did, it was usually something banal. The speaker wondering how I felt about toast, or telling me that the store would close in 20 minutes. All that work for something that didn't really matter. And so I began saying, "D'accord," which translates to, "I am in agreement," and means basically, "Okay." The word was a key to a magic door, and every time I said it, I felt the thrill of possibility. "D'accord," I told the concierge, and the next thing I knew, I was sewing the eye onto a stuffed animal belonging to her granddaughter. "D'accord," I said to the dentist, and she sent me to a periodontist who took some x-rays and called me into his conference room for a little talk. "D'accord," I said. And a week later, I returned to his office, where he sliced my gums from top to bottom and scraped what smelled like human feces from the roots of my teeth. If I'd had any idea that this was going to happen, I'd never have said d'accord to my French publisher, who'd scheduled me the following evening for a television appearance. It was a weekly cultural program, and very popular. I followed the pop star, Robbie Williams, and as the producer settled me into my chair, I ran my tongue over my stitches. It was like having a mouthful of spiders. Spooky, but it gave me something to talk about on TV. And for that, I was grateful. I said d'accord to a waiter and received a pig's nose standing erect on a bed of tender greens. I said it to a woman in a department store and walked away drenched in cologne. Every day was an adventure. When I got a kidney stone, I took the metro to the hospital and said d'accord to a cheerful, red-headed nurse who led me to a private room and hooked me up to a Demerol drip. That was undoubtedly the best that d'accord got me. And it was followed by the worst. After the stone had passed, I spoke to a doctor who filled out an appointment card and told me to return the following Monday, when we would do whatever it was I just agreed to. "D'accord," I said. And then I supersized it with "génial," which means great. On the day of my appointment, I returned to the hospital, where I signed the register and was led by a slightly less cheerful nurse to a large dressing room. "Strip to your underwear," she told me, and I said d'accord. While turning to leave, she said something else, and looking back, I really should have asked her to repeat it, to draw a picture if that's what it took, because once you take your pants off, d'accord isn't really okay anymore. There were three doors in the dressing room, and after removing my clothes, I put my ear against each one, trying to determine which was the safest for someone in my condition. The first was loud, with lots of ringing telephones, so that was out. The second didn't sound much different, and so I chose the third, and entered a brightly painted waiting room set with plastic chairs and a glass-topped table stacked high with magazines. A potted plant stood in the corner, and beside it was a second door, which was open and led into a hallway. I took a seat and had been there for a minute or so when a couple walked in and filled two of the unoccupied chairs. The first thing I noticed was that they were fully dressed. And nicely, too, no sneakers or sweatsuits for them. The woman wore a nubby gray skirt that fell to her knees and matched the fabric of her husband's sport coat. Their black hair, which was obviously dyed, formed another match, but looked better on her than it did on him, less vain, I supposed. "Bonjour," I said. And it occurred to me that possibly the nurse had mentioned something about a robe. Perhaps the one that had been hanging in the dressing room. I wanted more than anything to go back and get it. But were I to do so, the couple would see my mistake. They'd think I was stupid. So to prove them wrong, I decided to remain where I was and pretend that everything was normal. La, la, la. It's funny the things that run through your mind when you're sitting in your underpants before a couple of strangers. Suicide comes up. But just as you embrace it as a viable option, you remember that you don't have the proper tools. No belt to wrap around your neck. No pen to drive through your nose or ear and up into your brain. I thought briefly of swallowing my watch, but there was no guarantee I'd choke on it. It's embarrassing, but given the way I normally eat, it would probably go down fairly easily. Strap and all. A clock might be a challenge, but a Timex the size of a 50-cent piece, no problem. The man with the dyed black hair pulled a pair of glasses from his jacket pocket, and as he unfolded them, I recalled an early evening in my parents' backyard. This was 35 years ago, a dinner for my sister Gretchen's 10th birthday. My father grilled steaks. My mother set the picnic table with insect-repelling candles. And just as we started to eat, she caught me chewing a hunk of beef the size of a coin purse. Gorging always set her off, but on this occasion, it bothered her more than usual. "I hope you choke to death," she said. I was 12 years old and paused, thinking, did I hear her correctly? "That's right, piggy, suffocate." In that moment, I hoped that I would choke to death. The knot of beef would lodge itself in my throat, and for the rest of her life, my mother would feel haunted and responsible. Every time she passed a steakhouse or browsed the meat counter of a grocery store, she would think of me and reflect upon what she had said. The words hope and death in the same sentence. But of course, I hadn't choked. Instead, I had lived and grown to adulthood so that I could sit in this waiting room, dressed in nothing but my underpants. La, la, la. It was around this time that two more people entered. The woman looked to be in her mid-50s and accompanied an elderly man who was, if anything, overdressed. A suit, a sweater, a scarf, and an overcoat, which he removed with great difficulty, every button a challenge. "Give it to me," I thought. "Over here." But he was deaf to my telepathy and handed his coat to the woman, who folded it over the back of her chair. Our eyes met for a moment or two, hers widening as they moved from my face to my chest. And then she picked a magazine off the table and handed it to the elderly man, who I now took to be her father. She then selected a magazine of her own, and as she turned the pages, I allowed myself to relax a little. She was just a woman, reading a copy of Perry Match, and I was just the person sitting across from her. True, I had no clothes on, but maybe she wouldn't dwell on that. Maybe none of these people would. The old man, the couple with their matching hair. How was the hospital, their friends might ask. And they'd answer, fine, or, oh, you know, the same. Did you see anything fucked up? Not that I can think of. It sometimes helps to remind myself that not everyone is like me. Not everyone writes things down in a notebook and then transcribes them into a daily diary. Fewer